So this is the West Coast Project podcast for episode 7 of True Detective. After you've gone, hey Michelle.
Hey Mike.
This aired on March 2nd, 2014. We're catching up. We got this one and one more and then we're done. How do you feel about the show wrapping up?
It's a little sad. I really, really enjoyed this show. Really enjoyed it. Maybe number 2. Ever behind Breaking Bad, and it's only season 1, and I wouldn't have given Breaking Bad season 1 that high of a rating, I don't think. So
yeah, so what did you think about Marty and Rust having their little beer talk?
Well, having just said that and given it all the accolades I can think of to give this season, this was not my favorite episode. I really felt like there was a lot of information they had to get in. There was a lot of things that we had to know. And at times I felt like it was almost like they took the parts about it that made, and there was still some good parts, but parts that made it click with us or with me out of it in the interest of time, maybe. Like they were running out of time. I really felt like the ending was kind of rushed, and the more I go back over it, the more I'm convinced of that. But this episode felt like it was a necessary episode. I know sometimes you have to, you know, give the background, give the information, but it was a lot, and it was a lot to ingest, and I thought it was a lot at one time. That was my take. What did you think?
Well, this episode was a hard one to write notes down for a podcast because there was so much going on and so much time jumping. And
right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and time jumping within the same time frame, and yeah, it was really hard for that, but there was so much going on, and you just didn't have, I didn't have the time that they've normally given us to feel the emotions that the characters are feeling and stuff. It really felt like a lot of information to me. But yeah, Marty and Cole having the beer, I thought it was a long time coming. Hey, did we ever figure out, do we know, did Cole go back to Alaska like he told Marty he did? Because he said he did, but
yeah,
but the police officers think he didn't.
I think so, but just not during the exact times that Gelba and Papania think he was supposed to be there. Because, yeah, I think he says he came back and he worked. He was too cold. Remember, he said it was too cold.
Yeah, he did say that, but I think it was it Maggie? Somebody was saying that, was talking with him, and they were talking like he wasn't there, like he had been caught, and he had in the pictures of stuff going on, the Lake Charles thing and all that, but that he wasn't gone. I think that the detectives felt like he never left. Is that true? Is that what you got out of it? Because they made a couple comments.
I don't think it matters too much, but I don't know. I don't think it matters too much to the critical parts of the story.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting that it was hard to know. Although I'm not seeing Cole lie to Marty at all. So I don't know why he would lie about that. He said he went away for 10 years and been back for a couple years, right?
Yeah, he said he spent the last decade working in fishing boats and bars. So
yeah,
he came back from somewhere. I don't think he came back from, like, one parish to another. I think he kind of implied that he was in another place.
He said he was in Alaska. He said he went back to Alaska, for the 10 years or
so
whatever.
So I believe that's true.
Yeah, I kind of thought it was true, but I know that, or I think that the detectives didn't believe that. So I thought that was kind of odd and wondered kind of why they would think he had been there. That's what they said. I think the words were that he had been there all along. I don't know. I just thought that was confusing a little bit. But anyway, they're having a beer, and I think that was time, don't you?
Well, yeah, actually, Hart makes a reference in time about time. He says, Father Time has his way with all of us. And you must have really pissed him off.
Yeah, he's saying that time has not been Cole's friend.
Right.
I kind of have to agree with him, the way they've got him made up in that. What do you think?
Well, if you spend a decade drunk working fishing boats, it's not probably the best thing for your complexion.
Maybe not. Maybe not the healthiest environment, right?
Did you, when you saw this first part of this episode, did you doubt or believe that they could work together? Did you? Which one did you think? Did you doubt it or think that they could work together?
Well, I knew they would. I think I kind of knew they would. Would it happen in real life? Yeah, I kind of think so. And I thought that was another interesting thing, because we'll talk about it a little bit later when Maggie comes into the bar. But men seem to be able to put things behind them and kind of focus in the now a little bit better, maybe, with other men.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean compared to what women do? Like, what's the difference?
Well, not necessarily what women do, but what men and women do. Like, or women and women, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what is the deciding factor in it, but it seems like a lot of times when men and women have an issue, it's the end of something. I mean, it is the end, and it doesn't go forward. But if it's a male-male issue, a lot of times, at some point in the future, they're able to, if they reconnect, they're able to at least have some semblance of a relationship. That's just kind of been my experience. It may not be an
absolute. Men and men can do that, but men and women can't do that, or women and women can't do that?
I don't think men and women do that. I think when men and women break apart, like when there's some disconnect, like a huge disconnect, then I don't know that you see them years later being able to work together on something. You just don't see that. We even see it in this episode. A couple of years have gone by, and Marty is talking to his wife that he hasn't even seen in 2 years, his ex-wife, Maggie. He hasn't even seen her. He doesn't know what's going on with his kids even. I mean, and he didn't with Cole for a long time either, but he doesn't make that connection again with Maggie. And I'm sure there's other reasons why, but it's just, it just feels like when men and women have that disconnect, a lot of times it's more permanent, or it's just they have a harder time, maybe at least in the future, being able to connect on some level. And I think Marty and Cole, and that's, like I said, that's just my take, but I think Marty and Cole did here be able to, not right here, but they were able to reconnect.
Yeah, we talked about that in the last podcast, that friends kind of last longer than lovers do when they have problems and differences. Like, the bond between friends runs deeper. It sounds weird to even say it, but I think it really is true, that lovers kind of wrap things up and then say goodbye, and friends have more reasons to reconnect later on.
But why would you be a lover if you weren't a friend?
I would just say that it's been true in my life. I don't know if it's been true in yours, but lovers are long gone and friends are, like, still around.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, but that's kind of, you know,
You just said it.
I did. I know. I said it, and then I want to argue with you about it. So that's kind of a woman thing, or my woman thing, the way I do it. But
Cole doesn't forget his debts, and he tries to use that to get Marty back in. And, you know, Marty tries to back out, but Cole kind of implores him to pay his duty and debt for what went down in whatever went down in 1995.
Well, yeah, and I think what he's absolutely saying is that if they hadn't taken down Ledoux, that they would have found more people that were involved in this through Ledoux, or at least had the chance to, right?
That was part of it, that if Marty hadn't killed off Ledoux, they would have gotten information from him. But I think there's another implication that they got a little bit of it, but not all of it, and there was more work to do.
Right. And he told him he had a debt, and that's the part that kind of got Marty.
Yeah, and Marty doesn't, I don't even think he likes Cole very much at this point, but he knows
he ever did.
He knows
he never,
I don't know. I think he did. But he knows Cole's right, and that's the driving force, is that, you know, Cole's right, and they need to work together again.
But do you think Cole was threatening him when he said that?
No. No, I think he was imploring his, like, manhood, like, got to step up and pay your debt. You know, are you in with me? I'm, you know, we got to do this. There was really no other answer. There's like, well, no, I'm going to choose not to do this. That would not have been like a good story element, but you know, he implored his manhood and his duty to do his job right.
Well, I think Cole had feelings of remorse over the way things were handled with Ledoux in 95, because the whole case didn't turn out. More people died because they were trigger happy in that and you know, with the situation. But you know, I think Cole had some guilt feelings over that, and I think he maybe pointed them out to Marty, and then Marty kind of felt it as well.
Yeah, so I'm not even going to try to separate all the scenes because they jump around so much, but we learn a little bit about Marty in the time that's passed. He's trying to be healthier and doesn't drink as much alcohol as he used to, and he's given up coffee and drinks green tea and hasn't had a beer in a few weeks until that beer that he had with Cole. So what did you think about that, Marty kind of like on his own trying to rejuvenate his life?
Yeah, I didn't really think a lot about that. The way I took Marty was very sad. It was very sad. Marty had become what we saw Cole almost at the beginning. And as far as he was just alone, and he was talking about he had a girlfriend sometimes, and you know, but nothing serious. And then he had a serious girlfriend, and then when he's saying this, they're showing him clicking on an online dating site or whatever, and they show him pulling the top, the little plastic wrapper off this pitiful looking little TV dinner in front of the news, and they're just showing him being very alone. And I don't know if that was, I don't really know why. And then I can't really reconcile that with him trying to better himself. What did you think?
Well, I think like a lot of men who get lost kind of without women, because he did kind of have his life together work-wise. Like he had a fairly decent work life. He had a decent car, he had an office, he had a business, but he was just like alone. Like he didn't manage his social life.
No, it was like outside. I think probably he worked and went home at night and ate a TV dinner and went to bed is what it made it look like. But he really seemed more the loner like Cole was at the beginning. It felt like almost like Marty had regressed in that, because he did have a good life at one point.
Right, but Marty didn't totally fall off the edge of the world and just go into being like a destitute loser. He, you know, he kept his work appearances and his actual real work life going.
Right.
And kept that going. So anyway, Cole tries to implore Marty to come back to work, and it takes a while. And you know, we're going to steamroll a couple scenes here, because I know that other things happen in different times during this episode, but he basically has to show him this evidence up to the point of the video of Tuttle's video in the storage locker to get him to buy back in and come back to the case.
Well, right. He starts off with all of the circumstantial kind of evidence about what he's trying to do, about what he's gathered, about what's been going on. And then Marty finally concedes that he may have a case, but it's all conjecture or whatever the word he used. And then he says, there's no other way. You have to see this. And then he brings out the video.
Yeah.
And then so, we learn what happened and how he came upon it.
So Cole's storage locker kind of sets the anchor stage for the rest of the episode, but things kind of revolve around what they're investigating in the storage locker and a couple other places. But yeah, he sees this awful video of Marie Fontenot with the Mardi Gras party people And it's just really horrible video. Cole can't even watch it. He stands with his face to the door, away from the screen. And, you know, Marty watching it goes a little bit insane, almost like the Yellow King story, where if you watch the play, you go insane.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Hey, do you think Cole was living in that storage locker?
No.
Because they never showed him. Well, yeah, they did.
He lived behind the bar.
Behind the bar. Okay, well, he had a cooler and stuff in there, and it looked like he might have even had a bedroll or something in one place. So I didn't know, and the way he had it set up was like his old apartment. But I guess maybe he just stayed there. It was obviously his workspace.
It was set up as an office, like a little office that was private and locked up when he wasn't there.
And Marty didn't even trust him. Do you remember when he went there with him?
Yeah, Marty gets his gun out
and everything, and he comes in, and Cole asks him what he has, and he says a .38. And so Cole even noticed.
Cole disarmed the whole situation by like calling him on it.
Absolutely.
So we find out one of Cole's investigations takes him to Toby Bollert, and he's this guy that was part of the class that some of the people were in the Shepherd's Flock school.
Yeah.
And he's like a male prostitute in one of the bars now as an adult. And he remembered some stuff but didn't remember at all. Like he was partially asleep, but he couldn't move while he was asleep, but he knew what was going on. So really implied like he was drugged and he was like forced to participate in these awful things that the Tuttle group was doing to him.
Right, and that he felt like it was, he convinced himself that it was just a dream because the men all had animal heads.
Yeah. So we find out this Tuttle family did these little worship ceremonies down around Erath, which was this town where they had these pirate hideout back in the old days, but they held these Mardi Gras celebrations with men on horses and animal masks and the Career de Mardi Gras, which was the winter festival that had these awful celebrations by these crazy guys.
Yeah, I don't... all of that stuff is just lost on me. Is that that's not true stuff, correct? That's just stuff they've made up for this...
No, I think it's probably I think it's probably true, and the Mardi Gras that we see in New Orleans is like a much more distilled version of that. People wearing masks.
Not using it as an excuse to commit crime, maybe.
I don't know, but it's something. I mean, there's something probably to it.
Well, they called it the very rural sense of Mardi Gras, and... You know, he showed him the book, and it had the photos with the girls blindfolded with the antlers and the masks and stuff like that. But they were black and white, I think, is what I remember seeing. And I couldn't tell if they were supposed to be older pictures or pictures now. I just couldn't tell.
No, they were pictures from 1995 and probably a little before 1995.
And what about even since 1995?
Cole actually said something in the time that they were talking, which I guess was 2012. He said the stock paper for the pictures is 20 years old.
Oh, okay.
So
okay, I didn't hear that.
92, you know, whatever the dates. It was around 1995.
But then Marty just wants to know why he wanted him. He's like, okay, you know, you got your case or whatever. Why don't you take it to the detectives? Why? And of course, Cole trusts nobody. Because of the people he feels like are involved in it.
Yeah.
And he knows Marty still has the friends that he'll be able to get the information from, maybe that are on the force and stuff. And that's really, I think, the essence of why he came to him to begin with. Don't you?
Yeah. Yeah. He has no one he can trust except for Marty, who has a couple of resources, even if they're a little bit more limited than when he was as a detective.
Right.
As a private detective, he still has these other accesses to information.
Right.
So we learn a little bit about the Tuttle family, that Sam Tuttle is the father of Billy Lee Tuttle, and Eddie is the senator, who's the cousin.
Right.
And he's part of the family. And that Billy Lee Tuttle has died, and Cole denies killing him, but implies that some other people who knew about what he was up to probably killed him. Even though I think officially his death was ruled like normal or...
A suicide, wasn't it?
Was it a suicide?
I thought it was like an overdose or something. I don't remember. That's just what I'm thinking. I actually don't have notes on that, but...
Yeah, but Cole thinks his associates took him out because of all the stuff he knew. And he had those two houses, and the one that Cole broke into was the one where he found all the evidence, so...
Well, Cole broke into both of them, remember? And he only reported the one because he had to only report the one that sensitive information wasn't taken, because I took that to mean because if people found out that the other house was broken into where that the pictures and the videotape were, that they would have... You know,
Cole even makes a joke about it. Like, my whole life is an expanding circular fuck up, and I think it's about to close out with me getting clipped in a home invasion.
It was funny. He said that he had staked the houses out, and that he used the skills he learned, I guess, when he was working as a undercover.
Maybe. Yeah, he's like a burglar, I guess. Mm-hmm. He learned some stuff from his accomplices. So Hart checks in with Maggie, and we kind of see something about Maggie in 2012, and Maggie's automatically suspicious as to why Hart's checking in on her. And we see her. She's pretty comfortable. She's remarried. She's Maggie Sawyer. And she something implies something about a trip that she went on with her new husband to Paris. And she hasn't had any contact with Cole, but she still kind of cares about Hart. That kind of comes through in that scene. And she ends up being worried that Hart came by to say goodbye.
And he won't deny it. She flat out asks him, and he won't deny it.
Yeah. And then while he's with her, either that time or one of the other times that we interact with Maggie, we learn that Macy is working for AmeriCorps. AmeriCorps teaching, and Audrey is taking medication for a mental illness, and sometimes goes off her medication because she doesn't want them or doesn't think she needs them. Mm-hmm. She's dating a guy that Maggie likes. Audrey's dating a guy that Maggie likes, and she's an artist and had a show in New Orleans, and that she's probably pretty good at it, that her paintings are expensive.
Yeah, and she's sold some work, which is really good. But why wouldn't Marty know this stuff about his own children?
He just didn't. Either probably hurt a lot to stay in touch with them, or he didn't bother to stay in touch with them.
That just spoke volumes to me. That spoke volumes. I can understand the disconnect with Maggie because of the... terrible ending that they had, but the disconnect with his children, and he doesn't even know what's going on with them. That told me a lot about, I don't know, I kind of felt like, and I felt like this more, but he felt like he wasn't good enough for them, or good for them, or something. I kind of started getting that feeling. He seemed very grateful, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, for the information he's given about the girls. And I don't know, I was just really surprised about that, that he would
separate. Might have been too painful for him to stay in touch with them.
Yeah, I don't know that you get to do that once you're a father and you've raised the
kids. If you're weak, you are. If you're weak, you could be.
But... That's a line. It's a truth.
It's a truth, Michelle. He might have been too weak to find the strength to overcome the fact that she was with somebody else and the daughters weren't going to see him as much. And
well, it's obviously a truth, but it's a horrible truth that you could raise children.
It might be very horrible. It might very well be horrible, but I think that's a possibility. So they go back to the scene in the shed, and Hart and Cole are talking about more stuff, and I guess, you know, we talked about this already, but I'm having trouble with all the time and all this. Cole says something about he broke into Reverend Tuttle's houses, and his stint in robbery made him pretty good as a breaking and entering man. So maybe he did literally spend time in jail for robbery, or he spent time with people that were involved in those robberies or some robberies. But
I wasn't sure. I was thinking he was talking about as a police officer in that aspect, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, yeah. This is really hard to talk about because all the notes are like, they're linear about what I know about Hart and Cole, but they're not very linear in what happened in the scene.
Yeah, it's really hard to go back and forth in this. I agree.
But they dragged the evidence into Marty's office, and Cole says something like, people won't be coming in and out of here much, will they? And Hart just kind of looks at him like he's nuts, like, well, business isn't that good. So we kind of know that Marty's business is kind of struggling along.
Right, but he's got this big office, and it's pretty, it's like you said, I was a little impressed with it.
Yeah, and he has some cool access. He has, like, Auto Trax XP, I don't know what that is, but motor vehicle stuff, probably. And he has a people locator database and public records and some connections that are probably similar to what he would have had in the detective or police department.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, like a PI, I would guess. You know, just the kind of things that are legal to have, that you can have public record kind of stuff, maybe. But then when Cole gets in there, they start talking. And it was kind of neat how he kind of moved all of his storage stuff in there and everything. But they get in there and they start just having these not really deep, they are deep conversations. They're sentences, not really conversations. But Cole asks him about Beth, the hooker girl, the ex-hooker girl. You know, they talk about that for a minute. Did you catch that? And Marty said, you know, she had problems and he never should have started that.
Yeah, they start to talk about personal stuff on top of the case stuff.
Right. And that was interesting. Marty talks about how he worked another 4 years after Cole left. And, you know, Cole says, I thought this was pretty good. Cole's statement, of course, the whole series is just full of great, great one-liners. But he says, life's barely long enough to get good at one thing. Be careful what you get good at.
Yeah.
That was good. I like that.
And then Marty said he was going to play baseball and ride bulls until he became something he never intended.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know,
That was big life for them. It was pretty big stuff for them because they were, like, revealing personal things about themselves to each other.
Right, and I don't think they even did that before, because remember we talked about that way back in episode 1 or 2, where Cole's talking to Maggie about stuff that Hart didn't even know.
Right.
But then Marty is in Lutz's office, the guy he's a police officer. I'm not sure what his position is. And he's schmoozing him for the information that Cole's won. He's trying to find some information out. And he says he's writing true crime. He needs some old case files. And then he kind of greases him up with some single malt scotch, and he gets what he's looking for.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool that his buddy Bobby lets him in there, for one thing, but that all the stuff he needs is on paper files and not on computer files, which is kind of the jackpot, because if it was on computer files, it seems like it would be more available or accessible to everyone. And the fact that he has to dig deep into these actual, literally paper files makes it more likely that he's going to find what he needs and find things that other people have never uncovered before.
Yeah, well, the guy said anything before 05 that never became an official investigation were literally stacked in a room. I don't know how you would even preserve the paperwork like that. But, I mean, how would you even keep, I don't know.
It would keep, paper would keep 20 years later. Yeah.
I'm just thinking, like, you know, you get, what is it? the little bugs that eat paper, and I don't know. And this was a lot of paper. It looked like a hoarder's.
Yeah, there are libraries with books that are hundreds of hundreds of years old.
You got a point. Okay. That looked horrible. That would be my nightmare to go into a room and have to.
But it was kind of, it all worked in Marty's favor because the guy who was in there was like, all this crap's on paper. It's not even in the computer. You're going to have a hell of a time finding what you need. And you're like, I'm out of here. I'm not going to help you. That Marty just needed, that all worked out for him because he needed access to all that stuff and not having people help him. And I think just
give him what they wanted, right?
Being left alone in that room was like perfect.
And he ended up finding some stuff.
So we also find out about Cole's bar where he works is Domain's Domain or something. Domain's Domain. And it's Robert Domain who's the owner. And he's a guy who lost his son somewhere around 1985. And he thinks he was a Tuttle victim. Either Cole thinks that or Robert Domain thinks that or we're expected to think that.
Yeah, I don't remember hearing that he was, but I remember thinking he was now that I'm thinking back on it for some reason. So, yeah. And that's, it could have just been somebody that, one of the missing people that Cole was going around to, and then he ended up getting the job there because you would think, well, that's coincidental, but I guess it could work out like that.
Right. Yeah,
but they did find, was it Jimmy Ledoux?
Yeah, so they set up like, just like in Cole's storage locker place, they set up another little camp at that bar, and they have a couple meetings there.
Yeah.
And that jumps around a little bit. But yeah, so they talk about the Ledoux family. And I guess Jimmy Ledoux, Jimmy's father, somehow DeWall Ledoux or Reggie Ledoux transferred the title of a truck to Jimmy Ledoux, who owns an auto repair shop.
Right.
So that's how they got onto Jimmy Ledoux, and then they went and met with him at the repair shop.
Right.
And Jimmy Ledoux's kind of a straight shooter, good guy. He's not like Reggie or DeWall.
Right.
But we find out Reggie was his dad's second cousin. So related, but not really too close. And he has an auto shop. He's got no criminal records. He's married, and his wife's a teacher, and he's coach, and all. So Jimmy's a good guy. Jimmy kind of tells them a little bit about the nefarious Ledoux's.
Yeah, he talks about how they were even like that, even back when he was a child, and about a camping trip that he took with his father, or a hunting trip, I guess he took with his father. And that's when he goes into the fact that he has met the guy with the burns on his face. So that was pretty big, but they still don't know who he is.
Right. And he says, either DeWall or Reggie, I can't remember which one, but they always looked at you funky. And Reggie always asked about the girls at Jimmy's school. I guess Reggie was 10 years older, so Jimmy was in school.
Yeah, right.
And they always said crazy things, and this guy with the scars on the face. But then Jimmy never saw the guy with the scars on the face after, I guess, he was a student in school.
So, he never saw him after that night, he said.
Yeah.
He said, because they asked him, they said, did you ever see him again? And he said, no. And they kind of looked at him. He goes, I would remember. Because that guy really creeped him out.
Right. So he was a pretty good source of information. He kind of spilled everything. He was truthful. He was truthful even about his relatives being kind of evil.
Yeah, but they kind of almost hit like a wall there, I felt like. And I felt like that was one of the places that it was really interesting, and it was a lot of information already that we went over and everything. And one thing that we didn't point out is that when he went through all those files, there was no Marie Fontenelle file. It was gone.
Right.
So that's kind of an important thing, too. So her file wasn't there, which was the kind of one of the purposes of going there, among other things. But then all of that, and I don't know, the Jimmy Ledoux, what was the purpose of that? Because it didn't really lead anywhere, if you know what I mean. That was just, he told what he knew, and that the guy was creepy with the scars on his face, which is what we've heard again and again and again, and then it didn't go anywhere.
Well, and then Marty goes, DeWall and Reggie are dead, so they're, you know, they're just following up on every little angle they have.
Yeah, I just thought that was kind of an odd thing to throw in. It was interesting. I enjoyed it, but I didn't know if there was some connection that I had missed, because it was just like over to the side, they go find a good Ledoux and interview him, and that's just kind of it.
But then they meet Miss Dolores.
Yes, they do.
She was cool. I like that scene.
I did too. That was a great one.
And so she's living in this little project housing place where, you know, there's kind of gang activity outside, and it's kind of low rent district. But they meet Miss Dolores. She's this old black woman who was Sam Tuttle's maid, I guess.
Yeah.
And they found her via the income tax.
Yeah, somehow. From tax records, and she had drawn a paycheck from the Tuttles, from Tuttle's father, I guess Billy Lee's father, which was Sam, and she was a domestic, is what they actually called.
So did you notice the protocol that Cole used to interview her, like he did with all the other people?
What do you mean?
He touched her. He held her hand.
Oh, did he? No, I didn't notice.
Yeah, that's his way, man. He makes a physical connection. But she worked for Sam for 19 years back in Erath, and she knew Billy Lee and Cousin Eddie and all these people. And they find out that Sam had all kinds of kids outside of his marriage. He had lots of children, but he only liked a woman once. So I guess if he had sex once, that was it.
Yeah, and that was a lot of information for her to share. But I think she was kind of, I believed it, because she was kind of reliving it. She's not just throwing out these sentences about it. She's, oh, Lordy, honey, back in the day, they had so many children. And she's going on like that, and she's kind of reliving this. So it was a very believable situation to me.
Yeah, she had no reason to lie.
No.
And then we found out that Sam's, the guy with the scars is Sam's grandchild.
Right.
A Childress, and that his daddy gave him the scars.
Yeah.
So that was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And then we also see kind of a spiritual thing for this Dolores, Miss Dolores, that she recognizes the drawings that Cole shows her, the stick drawings about Carcosa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, the guys in Carcosa, it's the guy who eats time, and it's a wind of invisible voices, and death is not the end. And she's very animated and almost ecstatic as she starts talking about Carcosa.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then, of course, she gets like overstimulated from the situation and starts having some trouble breathing and catching her breath and stuff. And so the granddaughter is who's in there, asks them not so nicely to leave.
So where do you think she got the info on Carcosa?
I don't know that it was not openly practiced. Whatever this is, I don't know that it was. Now, of course, the part that the bad parts, the videotaped parts, were of course hidden. But I don't know. I don't know that it wasn't just openly practiced. What do you think?
Well, we have to remember that Carcosa is a place. So it's a place either real or imagined, but it's a place, a setting in people's minds. And I'm more prepared to talk about this after episode 8, but it's a place, you know, it's like a scene in somebody's mind. And I don't think it's a real place. I think it's an imagination of a place. But it's a place where someone who eats time and sees invisible voices and all this crazy stuff. So somehow she got this impression of this place from someone, maybe from being part of this household where she was the, you know, the housekeeper. Maybe Sam or somebody else in that household, you know, told her about this place.
I just kind of almost had it envisioned as a religion of the house or something, for lack of knowing how to put it better. Just an internal part of the household, because he didn't show her anything but drawings of those stick figures that we've seen the whole time.
Yeah.
That's all he showed.
I think we're going to find out that Carcosa is like a religion. Like, because religion, if you think about it, religion is a place that you imagine to be true. you know, it's like a setting that you imagine you'll go to after you die, or it's a place where you can go to be peaceful. That's how I'm gonna take Carcosa. That's what I believe Carcosa is.
Well, it's just, yeah, it's something that you as a religion know to be true. And that's why she maybe is so animated.
Yeah, she's ecstatic. She's very happy when she starts to envision this Carcosa or this memory.
And she's so excited that they know it too. So she really feels that connect, I think, with him. You know Carcosa? She keeps saying, you know Carcosa? You know Carcosa?
Right.
So.
And death is not the end. Like, when you die, you get to go to this heavenly place called Carcosa. And I think it could be heavenly or evil, depending on, you know, we have heaven and hell, right, in our religious spectrum. And I think that's Carcosa. I think it's an imagined place that, depending on your degree of religiosity, how much you believe in it, it's either very real or very ephemeral, but it's kind of a imagined heaven or hell.
Well, it seemed like someplace she was excited about, certainly.
So we go back to the bar setting.
But first, when he goes out, because she goes, death is not the end. Remember what Cole said?
Yeah, he wants
it. That was one of those great things.
He hopes she's wrong.
Yeah, I sure hope that old lady was wrong about death not being the end. And Marty just gives him these looks that Woody Harrelson does. They are great. They're perfect.
They also peel off a few 20s to the niece to give her happiness.
Yeah, not enough at first, and then a few more.
So anyway, they go back to the bar office, and they find out that Ted Childress signed off on the error of the report of Marie Fontenot missing, but it was Steve Geraci who took the original complaint. And he was the guy that was one of the early detectives that was kind of a peer of Marty and Cole back in the very first episodes. He's the guy that Cole slapped in the first or second episode.
Oh, was he really? Okay.
Yeah, but he took the complaint, and then Ted Childress just signed off on it. And that was when Erath was his beat, and now this guy Steve Geraci is a sheriff in Iberia.
Right.
So Cole immediately says, "Well, let's get out the jumper cables and the batteries and like get them to talk."
Yeah. Well,
and Marty.
Marty
tries to temper that down a little bit by saying, "Well, I'll talk to him directly, like on the golf course, and we won't go to the jumper cables right away."
Well, right. Marty decides that he might be the best choice for communication with him, since that's Cole's kind of first thing to do. And they also discuss that the only person who can arrest a sheriff is the governor. Did you notice that? Yeah.
So we find out that Cole is right and Marty's wrong, because Marty he's dicking around on the golf course. But all we find out is that Geraci wants to know why Marty's digging after this information.
Mm-hmm. And he also says that Childress is the one that took the report.
Yeah, so Geraci turns into the interrogator really more than Marty almost.
Yeah.
And Geraci's rolling around in this Maserati that he seized from a quarter bag of weed, mm-hmm. which nowadays it seems like such an abuse of justice, you know, this $100,000 car that he just possessed because of somebody driving around with a quarter bag of weed.
Mm-hmm.
But then Maggie goes into the bar and she says to Cole that she's worried about Marty saying goodbye, and tries to like connect with Cole a little bit, but he doesn't really have much to do with connecting with her.
No, that's what I was talking about at the beginning. He doesn't want any part of her.
Have you ever said goodbye to someone knowing that it would be forever in your life?
Yes, I have. Yeah, have you?
Yeah, of course.
But, you know, I mean, when she shows back up, he didn't have to... I don't know, I thought he was a little harsh. What did you think?
Well, you know, he's brutally honest. You know, what do you expect him? He could have broken character and said, "Oh, it's great to see you, Maggie, after you screwed me over." And what did you expect him to do?
Nothing. Nothing really. I just kind of hated the way that ended. And I don't really expect it to have ended. In other words, she should have never went there. But
it's a harsh show. You know, it is. It's not pussyfooting around.
No. No. He asked her to leave.
So, yeah, because she's classing up the place.
Yeah.
So, the next scene is back in Marty's office. So, I guess we have the storage shed, the bar, and Marty's office are three bases of operation.
Right.
Cole asks Marty why he quit, and he talks about the scene with the baby in the microwave.
Oh, geez, yeah.
You know, that was the last straw. I never wanted to see that again. And it took him, I know we talked about this, but again, I'm kind of wrestling with this time frame. But he quit 4 years after Cole left, and he could have been promoted more and more if he hadn't quit. So, Marty, what did you think about Marty kind of giving it up? Marty was kind of like turning into a Cole a little bit, don't you think? He didn't collect the paycheck and just follow his way up the ladder. He kind of got fed up with it like Cole did.
Yeah, I think he just couldn't take it. He just couldn't take it. And I kind of respected him for that. Marty has always, from the beginning, he makes me like him, he makes me hate him. He makes me like him, he makes me hate him. And I can always see some good in Marty. And I think, because they actually flash to the scene where they're going through a house and he opens a microwave. And, of course, it doesn't show anything. It's like showing it from the inside of the microwave. But it's just one of those things that you think, is there a paycheck worth that? Is there a paycheck worth the potential for that? And I kind of like that about him.
Yeah, I don't know.
No? Well, what do you think?
I think that he probably saw a lot of crap that most people wouldn't want to see at all. I mean, what about the very first scene? The girls posed as with antlers and a mask and kneeling, and who wants to see that?
I don't think anybody wants to see any of that stuff, but I think most people, certainly year after year after year, I don't know if you would get more hardened to it or if you would get more repulsed by it. And I think if you actually saw like an exploded infant stuffed in a microwave, I don't know. It's just the kind of things, I mean, I always try to tell my girls, once you see something, you can't unsee it. So be careful. And you just would never be able to unsee that. It would just be a forever thing and a forever horrible thing. And you know how he felt about kids. I mean, let's be honest. That's another one of the things that you liked about Marty.
Yeah, but the girl, I can't make that much of a distinction between the girl who was murdered and a baby getting killed. The girl was a young, you know, she's a youthful young person.
She was a prostitute.
She had her whole life ahead of her.
She did, but she was a prostitute, and this was an infant. I don't know. I can definitely see the distinction. Also, she wasn't mutilated. I mean, she was mutilated, but she wasn't mutilated. This baby was exploded.
Marty asked Cole why he came back, and he says it's something he had to do before he got on with something else. How his life's been a circle of violence and all the stuff, and he's ready to tie it off, mm-hmm. which left a pretty ominous, looming theme in the air as this episode wound down. Like, okay, we know this is like one episode left. It's the last one. There's not another. Right. Show next year, like something bad's gonna happen to Cole. I fully expected Cole to die in the 8th episode.
Well, right. Oh, and right after he had just said, I hope the old lady is wrong and death is the end, it was almost like he welcomed that.
Yeah, he wants relief from all this crap. So we're on the boat now, their boat with Marty and Jurassi, and they're fishing and drinking beer, and Marty's kind of coyly bringing up, you know, this. Well, one last thing about Marie Fontenot. Did you know the daddy? And, you know, ask him a couple more questions. And, you know, there was one question I had that I don't have resolved yet, is that the Sheriff Childress knew the aunt and uncle. And the aunt and uncle were the guy and the girl that they saw, the guy who had like the stroke problem.
Right, he that's what I took.
Mm-hmm. He was the LSU star pitcher, and Marty knew him and like kind of was in awe of him as an athlete back when he, when they were both young.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they were brother and sister, and they were the aunt and uncle of Marie Fontenot. What role did they play? What did you see them? What was the purpose of them being part of this?
Well, I don't think it happened like that at all. See, I think this is how I took it, was that then they knew he was absolutely lying because they had spoken to them. And these people were sick over what had happened to that little girl. Remember, they had their yard set up for her and all that kind of stuff. Remember?
Yeah.
And they were sick over this. They didn't like this at all. And the way that that this guy Steve's talking, the sheriff, he says that the sheriff at the time, Sheriff Childress, knew them, and he took the report from them that the little girl had went off with her birth father.
Like they just blessed it and said, goodbye, that's fine, you can take her away.
Right, or that he just came and took her, and whether they said it or not. But see, they know that didn't happen like that.
Why wouldn't they have stepped up back at the time? Why wouldn't they have stepped up and said, you know, wait a minute, where's our niece? We want to know what's going on with her.
I think they did, but they couldn't find the file. Remember, that was the file that was missing.
Yeah, but I guess that's partly my question. Like, if your niece was missing and somebody couldn't find a file, that would be the end of it for you. With you, you'd just be like, "Oh, well, okay."
No. I don't think the file was missing back then. What I think happened was they were pitching a fit to try to find the little girl because the mom was a druggie, right? And so she was gone, and they were pitching a fit. And the sheriff's office told them that the birth father probably got her. Remember?
Yeah, but you still want to connect with the little girl, like even if she's with the daddy somewhere, and just say, "Hey, you know, are you doing okay?"
Right. Well, you might want to, but you don't have any legal rights.
You just don't go merrily on your way with the rest of your life, not knowing and not wanting to find out.
No, you know, and I think they did want to find out, and who knows how long they looked. But if they're not a legal guardian in any way, they're not going to be given any information anyway. No information. So that whole thing rung true to me. This was a passing of the buck thing. Because
I know they just seemed too resigned at the time when they interviewed the brother and sister. The brother was not in very much shape to do anything, but they just seemed kind of resigned to the fate of this poor girl that was missing.
Well, I mean, if you have these people in positions of authority telling you that they can't give you any information and that their sources tell them, or maybe they even told them that she was with her father come got her because the mom was a drug addict, you wouldn't like it. But there'd be nothing you could do about it that I could think of.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I would have tried harder than they did. Especially the girl, the sister, the aunt, who was physically capable to dig a little bit harder.
I don't think that was her, was it? I think that was her daughter or something, wasn't it? Because she would have been older than that.
I thought that they were the brother and I thought the girl with the guy who had the stroke problem were brother and sister. And
I thought it was uncle and niece, so I could be wrong.
No, I think they were the same age. I think they were brother and sister, and thus aunt and uncle of Marie. And okay. They just kind of lost track of her, and then the sheriff told them that she's off with daddy somewhere, and they were like, "Oh, well, okay." But it just, I don't know. It left it kind of too open-ended for me. From an aunt and an uncle are pretty close usually to a niece.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But if they were told that he took off with her, we can't find him.
And well, then you try to find him and her some way on your own.
Yeah, I mean, but you're assuming that they care that much. And I think they cared a lot, but, you know, if they're told to back out of this investigation, I don't know. I don't know. It wasn't totally unbelievable to me. But this guy keeps telling them that the sheriff took the report.
Right. But on the boat, anything and everything Gerasi says, Cole one-ups him. You know, Marty kind of says, "Well, I'm done talking to you, but you're going to have to answer to this guy." And Cole's standing there with his gun. That was pretty cool. And everything Jurassic said as a threat, Cole would one-up him. That was cool. Like, Jurassic had no ground to stand on. Mm-mm. Like, I'm a sheriff, and do you know what a sheriff, how much power a sheriff has? And I forget what Cole says, but he never put any kind of fear at all into Cole.
Yeah, no, Cole's like, yeah, that's why I'm here, or something, or that's why we're doing this like this, or something to that effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't care. Well, they don't care at this point. At this point, it's they have to find out.
So then we kind of end this episode with P&G driving around lost like a couple of knuckleheads, arguing with each other.
Because they can't find the church.
Total fail, like fail. And they find Errol, the scar-faced boy, on the lawnmower, cutting mm-hmm. spirals into the lawn.
Yep.
And they talk to him a little bit, and then he tries to tell them even more information, and they actually cut him off. Even as he's telling them clues, they cut him off. Mm-hmm. And the scene kind of pans away, and he's cutting the spiral lawn into the cemetery field, mm-hmm. Kind of putting a stamp on Papanya and Galba and Errol, and the scene kind of ends. So what did you think about that, with P&G stumbling their way past this very important clue?
Well, I think it was kind of a nod back to when Cole and Marty did the exact same thing, almost. Do you remember when he was mowing the lawn and Cole had went up and talked to him? And Marty was in the car and starts, you know, beeping his horn because they've got a whatever, they found Ledoux or whatever, found something out about something. And the exact same situation had happened, and they kind of left him standing there talking to himself.
Yeah, not quite exactly the same.
No, because they weren't as bumbling, certainly. These guys had no place to be. They weren't called away, but they were very dismissive to him, the detectives were. He tries to tell them about his family, and they're just like, yeah, thanks, whatever, and kind of dry. They don't say whatever, but
right.
They implied whatever.
Well, yeah, they literally cut his sentence off, like, we gotta go, gotta be gone. Right as he was saying, my family's been here forever, for a long time.
Right. Well, so then they drive off, and he stands there, and he's looking out at them, which I thought was a really good scene. He's looking at them, and they pan the camera around, and that's when you can really see the scars. There's no, you kind of thought anyway, but there's no question about it at that point. You can see the scars on his face the way the camera pans around, and he says, my family's been here a long, long time. So, and then he slowly gets back on the mower and starts it back. So, yeah.
So the name game, what do you think the name After You've Gone meant for this episode?
Oh my gosh.
How about right then and there, after P&G left, if they had not left and they had caught him, what would have happened? What would have that have changed? You know, that would have saved a lot of agony for a lot of people. That's the first thing I thought of. After they left him there, after they were gone, he went on to do what we're going to find out in episode 8.
Yeah, that's, I think you're probably right. Well, and also after Cole was gone and the things that still were happening back there, and after Maggie was gone and what happened with her and her life, I think there was a lot of after you're gone's in it. But yeah, that ending was definitely an after you're gone and what else he's going to be up to.
Yep. And after like all the kids are gone, what does that leave for the parents and aunts
absolutely.
And uncles? And
absolutely.
So at the beginning, you said you didn't care for this episode too much.
It was good. The episode was good, and after I rewatch it, it's so good, but it's just almost too much. It was just an episode where there was so much information and so much time jumping and so many names, and I understood it had to be done, but I wish it could have been stretched out over 2 or 3 episodes in place of having all of that information in one. because I felt like it was kind of hard to follow, particularly just watching it. I mean, we watch it and then we rewatch it. We watch it with closed caption and we take some notes on it. And still sometimes I have to go back and go, okay, who did they say? What did they say? And look at it. And maybe I'm just slow, but I just felt like it was a lot of information.
Well, I think the whole momentum of the whole series kind of built up so much information that they ran out of time.
Yeah, I do too.
To properly close off all the different loose ends and stuff. That was my thought too. Is like where they left this. I mean, we still didn't know who the murderer was. We still didn't know how they were going to capture the whole crew from the Tuttle organization. Gilba and Papania are still looking for Cole.
They're still looking for a church, right? I mean, they can't find even their way back from where they came.
Right.
Yeah. And Marty and Cole are still on a boat getting information when this scene ends. I mean, it was so much and still so far to go in just one more episode.
Yep. So we got one more episode and then we're done, Michelle.
I know. We're done.
So any last thoughts for this episode 7?
No. I'm kind of... It's a lot of information. It's a lot. It was a lot to digest. Was it one of your favorites?
No, it's okay. I mean, it kind of fit in with the whole momentum building up to so much that there was really no proper way to close it off after, you know, after episode 6, there was too much to close off in 2 more episodes, 2 more hours.
I agree. Much too much.
Do you have your Saturnina Vudon costume picked out for Halloween this year?
I wouldn't know where to begin, so I don't know.
Are you just going to give away beads? You're just going to try to get beads by flashing your shirt?
I'm in Tennessee. I'm not even in Louisiana, so.
It's pretty close, isn't it?
Not that close, no. not real close.
Okay, well, closer than me.
It's closer than you, yeah.
All right, well, that's it for episode 7. After you've gone.
Yep. On to episode 8. On to the end.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you then.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.